Welcome to the 244th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Thank you for listening. We just got back from the first ever Punta Gorda Veg Fest. Adding Delaney Meinrich and Dawn and Barb from our office, we were all there. I spoke along with Dr. Greger. Beautiful setting in Lashley Park, Punta Gorda, so it was a great day. It was a Monday though, so it was goofy in that there weren't quite the amount of vendors that you usually see in a veg fest. But it was good. It was a good turnout. It's also nice that our little town of Punta Gorda, I'm not sure about the plant-based population. I know what we have. It's, you know, it's probably pretty good, but we have a lot of tourists in the area and it's right down in our tourist area of town. So I think we actually captured a lot of people that didn't know about plant-based nutrition, which is always nice. You know, people were hearing about what it entailed for the first time. And so I think it was actually very good. We did some lipid screenings at our booth that we had, and we sold our cookbooks, and we spoke to a lot of people about the upcoming conference. If you are new to this podcast, welcome. I live in Punta Gorda, Florida, which is the west coast of Florida, about an hour south of Tampa, and we're having our fifth annual Charlotte County Plant-Based Wellness Conference, March 28th. So if you're in the area and you'd like to come down and visit us for the day, we have a Plant Strong breakfast and lunch, as well as speakers. Pam Popper will be down, Karen Hartglass, Addy, Delaney Meinrich, myself will all be speaking. It's going to be a unique presentation this year in that we're going to do two talks each in TED style. So 18-minute talks that are succinct and to the point. There'll be a lot of time for questions. You know, one of the things that I noticed at the Veg Fest this past week was, you know, some of the speakers get on there and, you know, speakers kind of ramble on and talk about their slides. But, you know, if you know these speakers that are coming down, this is going to be an action-packed, short presentations with lots of times for questions, but a lot of information that's very stimulating as opposed to, you know, just dull, boring lectures that seem to ramble on and say the same thing. So you might think that you know everything about plant-based nutrition and general wellness, but I got to tell you, we're gonna wow you a little bit this time. We're going to relate genetics to nutrition. We're going to relate dementia to nutrition. We're going to relate screening to nutrition and how medical testing may impact your life, the risk and benefits. Karen Hartglass is going to talk about, you know, her life story and as an ovarian cancer survivor, as well as, you know, what she's been up to. She has a podcast, it's all about food. She has a nonprofit that raises awareness about plant-based nutrition, animal activism, environmental activism in New York City. So it's going to be a great, great day. We have some nice vendors. We're going to have, you know, it's all organic food. Most of the recipes are designed by us, so it's not just some catered event that, you know, from a hotel that just, you know, puts out canned beans and whatever. So we're going to have some really good food. Lots of times for question and answer, as well as a cooking demo at the end. So it would be a great day. You can get your tickets at drdelaney.com, drdelaney, or go over to Eventbrite and search 5th Annual Charlotte County Plant-Based Nutrition Conference. We're also having an immersion week before that. If you know, you still have a little bit of time, if you do it in the next couple of days, if you wanted to join us for a week-long immersion, beginning Monday morning, people are coming in and checking in Sunday night. And we're going to be doing three meals a day with people, exercise twice daily, lectures, personal consultations. So if you really want to get yourself healthy and have a mission and get a plan for when you leave here to go on, that's going to be our ultimate goal. I think a lot of immersion opportunities, you know, present themselves as a learning experience and lectures, but there's not a lot of hands-on. So when you go home, you're all excited, and then you, you know, run into all your friends that aren't plant-based, and it kind of falls out the window. At least that's what we see in our membership practice. People have been to various immersions, but don't really know how to apply it. So this immersion week is all about how to apply it into your life. So If you haven't checked it out, go ahead and check it out, and we love to see you. So, yep, the Veg Fest was a hit. We'll plan on doing that next year. Back to running my next marathon. Will be half marathon at Asheville on Saturday, followed by a full marathon at Asheville on Sunday at the Biltmore Estates. So it's a 39-mile weekend, so it should be great. Coming back here for the Immersion Week, and we have our first annual 5K as a part of our Immersion Week and Nutrition Conference Week, so that'll be fun as well. I should be good and sore. People have asked a little bit about the coronavirus and, you know, are we going to still have our conference? And yes, we are. I think that, you know, to date, what's been published about the coronavirus is that it is a severe flu. It affects males greater than women. It has something to do with what we call an ACE receptor, which is expressed in the lung cells. So that's what makes us dangerous from a pulmonary standpoint, that you can get leaky lungs, and that's requiring ventilator assistance in elderly patients and people with chronic obstructive lung disease. So, you know, the idea is if you're immune compromised, then extra precaution should be taken. There is, you know, if smokers are going to be worse hit than non-smokers, chronic lung disease, like I said, immunocompromised people, just like the flu would in any other flu that's out there. The treatment is conservative, not to go to the hospital, to, you know, hydrate and, you know, eat really healthy during the illness and actually to avoid the illness. And we'll talk about that in a little bit later. The incubation period can be 1 to 14 days. So you can be around somebody that most of the people have fevers, but there can still be probably some incubation and spread without having a fever. It's transmitted by a variety of ways, mainly large droplets, but it's also been shown to be transmitted in the stool and the blood. You know, people talk about face masks. If people aren't educated in sterile technique, chances are you're going to do more to contaminate yourself with a face mask than you're not. Certainly, if you're ill, you should wear a face mask to prevent transmission of your illness to somebody else. But otherwise, there's no real reason to do that just to protect yourself from the coronavirus. Hand washing is still the best thing you can do. Breathing through your nose and not your mouth is still a great advice. Not touching your nose and mouth repeatedly, especially if you're traveling on an airplane or you're in a grocery store. Again, frequent hand washing after, you know, anything that you're touching, you know, that's the biggest thing to do. To date, most of the fatalities, 97%, have been in China. There are 49 countries thus far, you know, on the cruise ship, those 700 people, the transmission, it actually made it worse because, again, a poor sterile technique that, you know, people aren't trained on a cruise ship to work in a hospital, but there's been a fair amount of transmission in hospital healthcare workers. So if you don't have to go to a hospital, don't go to a hospital to visit people just to go in. Certainly if you're sick, don't go into a hospital. Don't take little children into hospitals. That would increase their exposure. Again, most people, the symptoms are a fever, 83% to 98%, dry cough, 76% to 82%, you know, general flu-like symptoms, headache, sore throat, abdominal pain, little diarrhea. There's not much in the way that's available to most hospitals as far as diagnosis. There are a few blood tests that can lean towards having something. You know, we look at your white blood cell count, the lymphocytes are decreased. There could be an increase in LDH or PT, which is a clotting factor. Chest x-ray can show some infiltrates in some people. But again, the fatality rate is older adults, immunocompromised. it may be a little worse than the regular flu, but there's a lot of cases that haven't been accurately identified, so it skews the mortality rate. What can you do to help yourself? Well, you know, when you eat out, you're being exposed to people that may be ill, that may be not washing their hands, all kinds of contaminants in a restaurant. People don't wipe the tables down with, you know, really good techniques. So eating out is going to increase your exposure. So if you're immunocompromised, this is probably not the time to eat out every day. Use nutrition to improve your immunity. So that means eating a healthful plant-based diet rich in fruits and vegetables. Breathe through your nose. Quit smoking if you do. Don't touch your face or your hands, you know, with your hands or your eyes or your mouth. You know, be very cautious if you have contacts, making sure good hand washing. And then people that go to the gym, you know, you have to question, you know, the hygiene of various gyms. That's why I prefer working out outside. I do my runs outside. I think anything you do in the outdoors where there's good ventilation is much safer. So take your walking group outside rather than in the mall. Get outside and get a lot of sunshine. Keep active. And again, practice good diaphragmatic breathing. Food, look at citrus, mango, papayas, greens, you know. Don't forget garlic, turmeric, ginger, cumin as far as spices. Hot peppers have been shown to help, you know, with GI microbiome. Fermented foods, if you've had a dose of antibiotics for some other kind of cold, but tempeh, sauerkraut, these are all, you know, really good foods to consume to increase your gut microbiome, as well as high fiber foods. You know, avoid things that are high in saturated fats and oils, because again, those are inflammatory. They're going to be less protective than your kales and pinto beans that are high in omega-3s, flaxseed, chia seeds, you know, high in omega-3s. Keep dairy out of your house. Keep animals out of your house. Don't smoke in your house. Keep smokers away. Those are all things you can do to protect yourself. I think that this is an illness that, you know, people rushing to the grocery stores to buy bags of Doritos is not the answer. This is about eating healthy and improving your immune system that you can fight this disease off. If you get it, hydration is really important. You know, getting in, this is a good time to get your miso soup and your citrus in. Manuka honey is actually a good, has a lot of antimicrobial properties. I know, you know, strict vegans don't do any honey, but, you know, if you're going to pick one honey, this one does have a lot of antiviral, antifungal properties, and is very soothing for people that have the chronic cough. So green tea, add that to your diet. You can even put the green tea leaves into your oatmeal, so don't throw the stuff away. Recycle it, get all the nutrients that you can, and everything will be all right. I had some questions this week. Valvular heart disease and heart rate, but you know, does valvular heart disease have anything to do with nutrition, or does nutrition have anything to do with valvular heart disease? Just if you can remember your high school or college biology, we have four valves. The aortic valve lets the blood out of the heart to be oxygenated blood to be pumped to the body. The mitral valve, blood, oxygenated blood is coming in from the lungs through the mitral valve, and unoxygenated blood comes into the heart through the tricuspid valve and out to the lungs through the pulmonic valve. In the 50s, or, you know, I would say early before penicillin days, Streptococcus endocarditis was prevalent. People, scarlet fever would be one of the biggest reasons we would see valvular heart disease. Typically affected the mitral valve and the aortic valve second, sometimes both. Most of the people that would be affected by those diseases are probably in their 70s and 80s at this point. A sibling may have had rheumatic fever, and then, you know, somebody may have had scarlet fever, or maybe they wasn't even diagnosed. So that's one of the etiologies. So, if, you know, somebody has had a murmur for a lot of years. We do an echocardiogram. We can see changes that suggest that they may have had an old infection. We know now that cholesterol plays a role in especially aortic valve disease. Aortic valve disease, we call it sclerosis of the valve, where calcium forms in the caverns between the cusp of the valve, and or calcium forms, in, I guess, in the what you would call in the cusp of the valves that inhibits the valve from opening. We know that cholesterol plays a role in that. So again, plant-based diet will have an effect there. Inflammation has a big effect, you know. So if you're eating a highly inflammatory diet and you have a predisposition to valvular heart disease, that's going to accelerate it. People with kidney disease are more likely to get calcified valves. It's particularly the mitral valve that ultimately causes a leak of that valve. So a low-protein diet protects your kidneys. Low meaning 10% plant-based protein as opposed to a high animal protein diet. So those are things that you can do to help protect your heart valve. As far as, you know, and other, you know, the other etiology is high blood pressure. So when, if the heart is having to contract against a very high pressure in the vessels, then that causes the heart muscle to thicken and ultimately enlarge. It can cause a stretching that ultimately causes a leakage in the valve. People that are overweight that have sleep apnea develop pulmonary hypertension, which results in leaking of the tricuspid valve. So most of the valve issues are secondary to other things that causes strain and wear and tear on the heart. There's some genetic conditions, a bicuspid aortic valve, meaning there's two cusps instead of three cusps on the aortic valve. That happens in about 20% of the population, and those, because there is a bit of a turbulent flow across that valve. If you think about a stream where it's a little crooked, you see more turbulence or ripples in the water. That's kind of the way the blood goes out of the heart. So those valves tend to wear out a little bit quicker in some people. So more people with bicuspid aortic valves need to have a valve replacement or repaired than others. So what can you do if you have valvular heart disease? Well, again, try to decrease the things that are making things worse. So improving kidney function through a plant-based diet is going to help people not to deposit more calcium in those valves. Lowering cholesterol is going to help people that are prone to calcified aortic valves potentially have less calcification, a slower progression of their disease, a longer time period that they might have to have some repair done. Lowering your blood pressure to normal will decrease stretch and strain of the heart. So those are things you can do, you know, for valvular heart disease. Most people are asymptomatic. When we do echocardiograms to look at valvular heart disease, we're able to pick up very small changes in the valve, whether the valve might, what we call blood may backflow, or we say that valve leaks. It doesn't leak outside the heart, it leaks within. So the blood, you know, typically the blood comes in through the mitral valve, down into the ventricle and out the aortic valve. Well, occasionally when the heart contracts, some blood can backflow into the left atrium, and that can cause stretching over time. And we can pick little changes of that over up. There's a disease called, you know, we've heard about mitral valve prolapse. Occurs a little bit more in women. Interestingly, if it occurs in a man, it's usually more serious than in a woman. There's been a lot of misdiagnosis of that. The tissue in the valve is just a little bit more floppy. It makes it more prone to blow back blood the wrong direction. And over time, that can continue to leak a little bit more. Some of that is hereditary. When we talk about, you know, a genetic risk of valvular heart disease, again, it's down in the range of 10%, like all other genetic diseases that are multifactorial. We don't know what gene causes aortic valve or mitral valve disease, but certainly decreasing your risk factors to cause things to get worse is, you know, the best way to go ultimately. So proper, you know, good plant-based nutrition is never going to hurt anybody. It's going to make things better and less likely to progress. There was a question about athletes and sudden death. And, you know, should you not exercise too hard because you could drop dead. And, you know, certainly we hear every once in a while of an athlete, you know, either a collegiate athlete or even a high school athlete or college athlete having sudden death. There are diseases called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, where there is, more of a genetic predisposition of a thickened heart muscle in such a way that the blood doesn't get out of the heart like it should, so the heart almost contracts upon itself a little bit. Typically, when you listen to somebody's heart, you can hear that. Occasionally you can't, but most of the time you can hear that, so a good screening physical should pick those things up, as well as valvular heart disease. Certainly, if there's a family history of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, people should get an echocardiogram to exclude that. And also, you know, an athlete should, if there's a family history of that. Occasionally, there is a congenital abnormality of the way the coronary arteries come off of the aorta. Typically, the coronary arteries sit on top of the heart like strings on a football. So the arteries aren't inside, but the big ones that we get at are on the outside. And they go on the outside of the great vessels. Great vessels are the aorta and the pulmonary artery, but occasionally an artery will course between, and it can get crimped when there's high pressures and increased blood pressure. And so sometimes with an athlete is, you know, under heavy exertion and there is one of these crimped arteries, then people can have a problem with blood flow and even have cardiac arrest. There's also some primary rhythm problems that people can have that they are prone to arrhythmias. A lot of these people have presented before with fainting spells or passing out spells with a sudden excitement. Somebody's very startled can trigger one of these arrhythmias, or people have near passing out episodes. They can be an arrhythmia that it can actually be fixed through ablation and testing for those rhythms and actually burning those pathways. And it's less likely in younger, you know, people, especially young males. That's a less likely type phenomenon, but can happen. Again, very, very rare. Blood clots. There was a presenter at the Veg Fest that had a blood clot in his arm. Typically, there's, when people have abnormal clotting factors, that can be, again, a congenital disease. People that are overweight, people that are sedentary, people that have swollen legs tend to be more prone for blood clots. People that have cancer tend to be more prone for blood clots. People that undergo profound dehydration on a regular period could potentially be higher risk for blood clots. People that have abnormally high hemoglobins, when people dope and they take EPO and their hemoglobin goes up and they get dehydrated, that's what causes them to have an arrest and die. So those aren't things that are very common in the general athlete, especially the weekend warrior. Most weekend warriors or older adult athletes need to worry more about coronary artery disease. You know, 40% of 40 to 50-year-olds have coronary artery disease. It goes up. 60% of 65-year-olds have coronary artery disease. 70% of people over 70 have coronary artery disease. Doesn't mean it's 90%, but even if it's lumpy bumpy, little 20%ers, those plaques can crack and cause a heart attack. So, people need to keep in mind of the symptoms when they're exerting. You know, all of a sudden we get all excited about being, plant-based or losing weight, and we're going to try to exercise it off. I have people come in here all the time that say, you know, I haven't been able to lose weight because I haven't been able to exercise, but now we're going to exercise and really try to burn things off, and we're going to really pound. And so they go out and they don't listen to their body because they run, you know, so they're exercising way too fast, and getting their heart rates up way too fast for their level of fitness. And if they have underlying coronary artery disease, that can be an issue. I'm not a fan of people going out that have been couch potatoes and trying to do a marathon in the first, 3 months of exercising. I'm not a fan of these boot camps I'm not a fan of the boot camps where people that haven't been doing anything all of a sudden are being pushed to exhaustion to try to get weight off. I think that's, you know, that's unnecessary. On the other hand, I think that probably a large majority of people don't push themselves enough. And that they baby themselves and, you know, probably don't get the exercise that they need to. You know, if you get 10,000 steps a day and it's been walking around the mall, you know, very, very easy and never getting a sweat up, that's probably not doing as much as you possibly could do. So it's got to be someplace in between. And, you know, as far as general guidelines, as far as heart rate monitoring during exercise, you know, the basic way to determine your maximal heart rate is 220 minus your age. And that's not accurate for, you know, completely accurate. It's a really good ballpark, probably within 10% of most people. And so that's your maximum heart rate attainable, meaning that if you were to run a 5K or a 10K and all out, that that would probably be the maximum heart rate you could attain. We typically find that by, you know, a stress test, what we call a Bruce protocol. We have people exercise every 3 minutes. The treadmill gets a little steeper. The incline's a little steeper and the pace is a little faster until we reach the point where a person can't go any further. And, you know, we call that their maximum heart rate, you know, depending on their exertion, some other things, but that's a good way to get a maximum heart rate. And, you know, if people are on medications, they're not able to achieve that heart rate. People are on beta blockers, can't achieve a maximum heart rate. But we don't want people to exercise routinely to their maximum heart rate. Typically, if somebody, you know, for instance, running a 10K or marathon, they might be going 80 to 90% of their maximum heart rate. But that's not what you really want to train at all the time. You'll get a lot of benefit by doing the majority of your training at somewhere around 65 to 70% of your predicted maximal heart rate. Even 60, 65% walking, you know, it's a pretty vigorous walk that you're going to get your heart rate up. Women tend to have higher heart rates than men because we have a lower hemoglobin. So your heart has to, you know, your hemoglobin carries your oxygen. So the hemoglobin has to be shuttled around more. So your heart rate goes up so your body can put out the blood that it needs. People that have a weak heart muscle tend to have a higher heart rate if they're not on medication because, again, the heart's not pumping enough blood, so it has to pump it quicker or more frequent. When you're dehydrated, your heart rate goes up. You know, people talk about exercising and being dehydrated. Most of the time, people aren't truly dehydrated, meaning that they've lost, you know, volume of their blood. The water's gone out so that their vascular volume is decreased. Most of the time when we sweat, we're actually losing, especially during exercise, we're losing what we burn. We burn carbohydrate and the product is water and carbon dioxide. So that is a lot of the sweat and volume that we actually generate. So looking at, you know, I lost 7 or 8 pounds during whatever, a lot of that is actually from the breakdown of carbohydrate and not loss of intravascular volume. There was just the Olympic trials this past weekend, you know, and those people are running full tilt. It was pretty cool, but they don't get profoundly dehydrated running full out 26 miles. So most people aren't going to get dehydrated with an hour of exercise. So, you know, it's kind of funny. You see everybody with, you know, a bottle of water, a bottle of Gatorade at the gym. Really not going to lose that much intravascular volume that you need to, you know, be so concerned. And probably if you do go to the gym and especially with the flus and viruses and things out there, you're probably better off, you know, not exposing yourself in that water bottle to carrying around in your dirty hands. So, especially for short bouts of exercise, I wouldn't worry with it. The more fit you are, the more slowly your heart rate goes up and the more quickly that your heart rate comes down after exertion. So the more you exercise at, you know, this 65 to 70%, the quicker you'll be able to go at a lower heart rate. The other thing that concerns your heart rate is how you breathe. If you're breathing through your mouth, your heart rate's going to be higher than if you're breathing through your nose. And that has to do with, you know, you're not going to be delivering as much oxygen to your tissues when you're breathing through your mouth. You're blowing off more carbon dioxide. So another way to lower your heart rate is to breathe through your mouth. Or I'm sorry, to breathe through your nose, to train your lungs to do that. So, you know, the bottom line is, people come in and they have these, you know, Garmin watches or whatever, and they never look at their heart rate, or they never look at it and actually use the data that they have. But they are pretty accurate. Even the Fitbits and some of the, you know, the Garmins, the iWatches, you can look at your heart rate. It downloads to your phone, and you can see what your heart rate's doing. And if you're having spikes overnight, it'll tell you. If your heart rate goes up in the night 10, 15 beats, overall compared to other nights, maybe that you're becoming ill, or you've had poor sleep, or that you're more fatigued. So they're good things to actually look at. It's good to look at your heart rate over time, you know, your activities. If you're walking 3 or 4 days a week, I think it's great to keep a calendar of what, you know, what your average heart rate, your max, your heart rate, your minimum heart rate was. Again, a lot of the apps will keep that for you. Garmin has a great Garmin Connect. It's great to look back over time and see what your heart rate's doing. There are other programs out there that you can, Training Peaks and different peaks you can upload your information to. Strava has a way to upload that you can actually look at these data over time and get something out of it, so that you know if you're getting better or you're stagnant. And if you're stagnant, then, you know, perhaps you might want to change something. Sleep is another thing that can be tracked on a lot of watches. And, you know, people look at, you know, how much time that they were sleeping. I think screen time is probably one of the worst things that's happened over the last 10 years to make people's sleep patterns poor. But there was a study recently published in the journal American College of Cardiology that looked at changing your sleep wake time by 90 minutes in either direction increases your chances of having a heart attack or heart disease. So what that means is as little as a 30 minute difference on average across 7 nights could cause a problem. They looked at 2,000 people aged 45 to 84 without any cardiovascular disease over 5 years. And people that had this most variation over the 7 nights had an increase, a twofold increase in the risk of cardiovascular disease over 5 years. If your standard deviation and, you know, the sleep duration varied by an hour, there was a 36% increase in cardiovascular disease. So every hour that the sleep, there was a sleep difference, you know, over the 7 days, 18% change in risk. And that persisted even though people were shift workers. So it's good to have stable sleep patterns. And we all kind of know this. Sleep deprivation is not a good thing on a regular basis. You know, people trying to work the clock at both ends, or staying up very late some nights and then going to bed, you know, then sleeping during the day. So it's, you know, it's good to get your sleep patterns down. Here we're getting ready to come into a change in our clocks being spring forward this weekend. And that's, it really messes a lot of people up. I know it messes me up, because you're not quite tired when you need to be, and then you're tired the next day. So you have, you know, that's going to be an hour that we lose right there over this next week. So we have to adjust ourselves, you know, gradually backwards, so that you're not, you know, that you're getting adequate sleep. So you know, what this study was suggesting is, it's not even amount, it's a duration, but it's this frequently changing. So to sleep 3 hours or then sleep 7 hours, you know, or have several nights up where you're lacking in sleep, is probably not a good thing over time. Sleep hygiene is really important. I think there are people that are sleeping more than they think they're sleeping. You might be kind of active dreaming. But I think the good sleep hygiene, you know, not watching TV in the bedroom, if you can get rid of your screen time, you know, before you go to bed, good time to do some meditation. If you can't get to sleep, you know, then, you know, this is a great time to practice your breathing, slow diaphragmatic breathing in through your nose, out through your nose, cooling the room off, keeping it dark. Those are all good things. And again, not, you know, staying up really, really late, watching something scary and then trying to get up really, really early. That's obviously not a good idea. I think avoiding sleeping during the day, people get into some really bad habits of taking naps to catch up. And so that they're, you know, sleeping a little bit here and there all day long. You know, I think that's hard on getting you your sleep cycles regular. Again, breathing habits, people that have sleep apnea tend to have wakeful, restful, restless periods. So practicing your breathing while you're awake so that you're breathing through your nose will help you to actually have better sleep at night. Breathing through your nose will help you to have better sleep at night. If you snore, if you wake up tired, if you fall asleep driving, those are things in your overweight or you, you know, you stop breathing, you know, you should have a sleep study and get that evaluated. I think, you know, if I'm a morning person, some people say they're a night owl, but so you should keep it that way, but you have to adjust to life, you know. So I think that you, if you're going to make a change, you make a change gradually. Start backing up. If you're you know, go to bed at midnight, start backing up and going to bed earlier. Set your alarm and get up at a reasonable time in the morning so that you can readjust yourself. Certainly never ever get up and eat. You know, that's just, you have increased cortisol levels, increased clotting factors during the night. That would be a bad thing to do. Again, I think if people wake up and they have chatter, it's a good time to meditate, as opposed to, you know, getting up and doing something else. I think, you know, foam rolling, stretching before you go to bed, relaxation, those are all good techniques so that you don't have kinks that are keeping you up. So those are some things to try to improve your sleep. Alcohol use has been associated with poor sleep patterns. People notice heart rate spikes through the night, so excessive drinking before bed is going to decrease sleep patterns as well. So that's something to take into consideration. Some people, you know, doing some yoga or some mild exercise helps them sleep. Some people it winds up, so that has to be an individual thing. But, you know, again, back to the stretching and meditation type things, I think are very, very helpful. So takeaway for the weekend, get your exercise. We know that people that are sitting 7 hours are increased risk for cardiovascular disease. So go out and move. Try to do most of your movement in the 70 to 85% of your predicted maximal heart rate. Follow them over time. On the sleep change for the weekend, you know, it's why they do it on the weekend, so you can kind of back yourself up. I've been getting up a little bit early, which is going to simulate next week. So it's not as big a transition, but, you know, give yourself time, keep your bedtimes. You know, you might change it for a half hour one way or the other. And so you kind of gradually go into it this week without that big old jump. So work your way back into it. Keep your hygiene up. Wash your hands frequently. Keep your immunity up. Increase your citrus, your fruits and vegetables, broccoli, ginger. It's a good time to put garlic on things, turmeric, cumin, hot foods, spicy foods, and everything will be okay. It'll be the best weekend ever. So enjoy yourself. Get your tickets for the 5th annual Charlotte County Plant-Based Nutrition Conference at drdelaney.org. It's drdelaney, or go to Eventbrite. Come down and see us for the immersion week, but you got to do it quick because we're going to close that up on Tuesday. So get your tickets for that. There will be a price increase for the conference next week, so get your tickets this weekend. Time is running out. If you haven't got our cookbook, go ahead and get that, because that's going to help you get started on your plant-based journey, get your meals on the table quickly without much fuss or muss. So have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you soon.